Thank you very much. I would like to thank the sponsors, the organizers of this event, as well as all of you for being here. I had the opportunity of speaking in this auditorium many times in the past, so this is very familiar place to me. And MIT was a very special place for me, partly because of my friendship with many people here. One of them is Professor Chomsky here, sitting on the podium. In fact, it was Professor Chomsky who introduced my first book manuscript to MIT, which was published in 1973. That book manuscript had been delayed or kept at the Harvard University Press for 3 years, and so we retrieved it and we got it to MIT, and MIT published it promptly. So thank you very much, Professor Noam Chomsky. In fact, he also introduced other manuscripts of mine, one of which was an 800-page study of the Vietnamese rural area during the French colonial period. And MIT was going to be to publish it when I got a book contract by Random House, Pantheon Books, and I went to Vietnam for 7 months. After I got back from Vietnam, there were attempts on my life, and I was not able to turn the book manuscript into MIT in time. When I, the revision, when I did the MIT humanities branch of the MIT Press, went belly up. And the same thing happened to my Pantheon books. By the time I finished that book, Pantheon also went belly up. I'm telling you this story not to say that, to warn publishers who associated me with go bellying up, but to say that, you know, personally, I myself, because you want me to talk on a personal level, have had to deal with many pressing issues, and I decided that scholarship can be pushed aside. And one of the urgent issues that I've had to deal with in the last 30 years is to confront the incredible rewriting of history, of the history of the Vietnam War on both sides of the Pacific, in Vietnam as well as in here in this country. I'm not going to talk about the revision of history in Vietnam, but what I want to say is that, interestingly enough, the official lines in Vietnam and the official lines here in this country converged after the war ended. Particularly the fact that, you know, the United States claimed that the war in Vietnam was created, or the aggression, the communist aggression in Vietnam, was started by the communist North, and the communist government in the North was responsible for all the destruction and victory or whatever in the South. And interestingly enough, the regime in the current regime in Vietnam for the last 30 years also want to claim that the lion's share for the victory in Vietnam was because of Northern contribution. And so, you know, when you try to confront the rewriting of history on both sides of the Atlantic, you get fired at on both sides. And so you really have to spend a tremendous amount of time dealing with that. Having said that, today I'm only going to talk about part of the rewriting of history here in this country and not deal with Vietnam. The rewriting in of history in this country started, you know, on the very day that Saigon fell. And Kissinger went on TV right away saying that, you know, the reason why there was the loss of Vietnam was because, not only because of peace movement and Congress betraying the American effort, but also because the North Vietnamese got tremendous amount of aid from China and the Soviet Union during the last 2 years after the signing of the Paris Agreement, and that was why the war in Vietnam was lost. And so forth and so on. And now, you see, to the extent that now, that, you know, people in power can make any kind of statement they want to say about the Vietnam War. For example, if you remember 2 months ago during the election in Iraq, President Bush stated that, you know, we are going to win in Iraq now because the Iraqi people really love freedom and democracy, not like the South Vietnamese. The South Vietnamese never wanted to fight for freedom and democracy. That's why we lost the war. I don't know how many of people remember that kind of statement. It was precisely because of the Vietnamese struggling for freedom and independence and democracy, and that's why the United States lost the war. But never mind about that. You know, what I want to do today is to focus on one small issue. It's not small at that, but one narrow issue, and that's counterinsurgency. Because, you know, in the last 2 years, we almost every day we hear about counterinsurgency as if this is a new magical weapon that, you know, that the United States is going to use, has been using in Iraq and the Middle East, and somehow we are going to win this time. It's not like Vietnam, you know. And you know, almost every week we hear the story about Iraq is not Vietnam. Of course we know that Iraq is not Vietnam. It doesn't take that much intelligence to know that Iraq is not Vietnam. The question is whether American strategies and tactics used in Iraq are the same as those in Vietnam. And counterinsurgency was not invented in the last 2 years. Counterinsurgency was invented, you know, at least as early as 1952. But to make the story short, it was applied in Vietnam as soon as the Geneva Agreement ended in 1954. And the United States right away sent its generals into Vietnam to try to conduct a counterinsurgency program against the former Viet Minh cadres in the South. Viet Minh stands for the League of Independence for Vietnam. At that time, they did not call it counterinsurgency, they called it pacification program. And the pacification program was started in November of 1954. The U.S. Joint Chief of Staff ordered the prompt reassignment of selected personnel and units to maintain, and I quote, "the security of the legal government in Saigon and other major population centers and execute regional security operations in each province and perform territorial pacification missions." So how was this territorial pacification mission was carried about? Incredible assassination and killing of people at the local level. Of course, I was too young at that time. I didn't know about that, but I did read about that. And in the Saigon newspapers, for example, they talk about, you know, how many communists they kill on a daily basis. So by 1956, the Saigon regime launched, with U.S. aid, tremendous amount of money and weapons, what was known as Phong Trào Tố Cộng, the Communist Denunciation Campaign. The Communist Denunciation Campaign was also the campaign to annihilate the communists. And at that time, they invented a term, Viet Cong. Actually, you see, according to the former director of propaganda in Vietnam, Nguyễn Văn Châu, Nguyễn Văn Châu said he coined the word, and the word was Viet Cong, Viet Cong. Viet Cong, pronounced in Vietnamese, South Vietnamese pronunciation is Viet Cong. Viet Cong also means to annihilate the communists. And so that was what the program was all about. Well, Saigon, in May of 1956, the Saigon government officially announced that 100,000 former Viet Minh cadres in the South had, quote-unquote, rallied to the government or surrender, and tens of thousands had been executed or sent to quote-unquote re-education camps, i.e. prisons. In spite of this fact, Hanoi forbade the people in the South to fight back, because Hanoi was counting on the fact that for some reason the United States would allow free and fair election to be carried out according to the Geneva Accords so that the country could then be reunified peacefully. The United States, however, stated many times during that period that if free and fair elections were to be carried out under international supervision, then the Viet Minh would win by at least 80% or 90% of the votes. So therefore, you should not allow the free and fair election to come about. And in order to be able to maintain this quote-unquote legal government itself, you have to kill the communists. And that's later on, by 1959, was known as counterinsurgency, but not by this time. Now, because Hanoi was responsible, in part, for not allowing the people in the South to fight back, tens of thousands of people were killed because the military range of the Viet Minh had moved north with all their weapons, or most of the weapons. The people who remained in the South were political cadres. So for years, in Vietnam, the official line was not to talk about the casualties in the South during the early period of the Diem regime for fear that people would blame the North for having allowed this to happen. However, by 1995, Hanoi had to admit in a book entitled The Overall Assessment of the War by the Central Command of the Overall Assessment of the War of the Political Bureau of the Vietnamese Communist Party. This is a mouthful. Anyway, the book admitted that about 90% of all political party members in the South had been killed by 1959. In the Mekong Delta alone, 70,000 party cadres had been killed. Over 90,000 other party members and local inhabitants had been arrested, jailed, and tortured. In the central provinces, 40% of all provincial cadres had been killed. 60% of all district cadres and 70% of all village cadres also had been killed. In some provinces, only 2 to 3 cadres remain. Only in Tri Thien, which means combined provinces of Quang Tri and Thừa Thiên, did 160 of the former 23,400 cadres survive. This was the extent of the killing at that time. The people in the South was forced to resist. And so in January of 1959, in Hanoi, the 15th plenum of the Communist of the party in Hanoi met, and out of that came the resolution allowing the Southern population to use force to defend themselves, with the added emphasis that only when absolutely necessary. That was the emphasis. So the people in the South, of course, regarded that the situation was absolutely necessary for them to fight back. And so they took up arms and began to fight back. And many districts in the southern part of Vietnam, in the Mekong Delta, were liberated during this point. In the United States, Senator Kennedy was running for campaigning for the presidency, and his military advisor was General Maxwell D. Taylor. Maxwell D. Taylor was a strong advocate of counterinsurgency. He believed that the United States should enhance what was known as a special forces capability to deal with counterinsurgency everywhere in the world. He published a book entitled The Uncertain Trumpet in 1959, which Kennedy used as his foreign policy platform. Taylor argued that the United States should place had placed too much emphasis on nuclear deterrence, and as a result, the communists were exploiting American weaknesses everywhere, especially in the Third World. So the United States should should develop counterinsurgency capability, which is also known as limited war capability, to fight against the insurgents. And insurgency was also known as domestic aggression. Why am I telling you this story? I'm telling you this story because, you see, General Maxwell Taylor was chief of the army, and there was a turf war between the army and the navy and the air force. Because, you see, massive deterrence as a policy meant that the United States were putting in a lot of money in the Navy, into the Air Force, so that they could have this delivery capability for nuclear weapons and so forth and so on. That left the Army out. And as far as the Army was concerned, you see, after you have a war, then what's the role of the Army? Come in and clean up the mess? No, sir, we want an active part in this thing, too. And so the turf war in Vietnam became a real war. The turf war in the United States became a real war in Vietnam. When Kennedy became president, he adopted counterinsurgency as a policy. And he began to send massive number of so-called advisors to Vietnam. Most of the advisors were special forces people. Now, I also happened to, at this point, to be employed by one of the branches of this counterinsurgency. And I was a very young man. I was 16. I didn't know anything about this. And what I wanted to do was to be able to travel around the country. And at that time, you know, you could not travel around the country. I mean, there was kind of like an internal, in order to go from one district to another district, you have to have a passport, an internal passport in order to travel. And I wanted to find out what Vietnam was like. So this was an opportunity for me. I happened to meet some of these generals at an exclusive club in Saigon, the Cesse Sportif. And I said, you are hiring Filipinos and Japanese and these people, and they don't know about Vietnam. They are apt to get themselves killed. And 2 months later, two Filipinos were killed in the Mekong Delta. And so they got back to me and said, hey, you know, how do you know about this? So you want to work for us. And so at a very young age, I worked for the United States, making military maps. But they were making different kinds of military maps then. Ours was the least obnoxious thing, because we were basically making military maps, but there were also another part, which was making maps of villages. And the people who were making maps of villages were the people who were really engaged in counterinsurgency. Counterinsurgency included pacification, it included population control, it included and population control and counterinsurgency and pacification. All these things, they used different kinds of methods. For example, there was what was known as an anti-malarial disease program. They had people going throughout the country spraying people's houses, and so people had this thing, and they go to people's house, take things out of the house, spray, and when they took things out of the house, they tried to find out where there were subversive literature and this kind of thing, and then a week or two later, those people who were considered suspect were carted off. And I found out very quickly that this is what happened. As soon as an anti-malaria team goes to a village, then a couple of weeks later, people were arrested and killed. And then, of course, they had doctors and engineers and agricultural experts and civic teams of all kinds going through the villages. And you would think that they were doing nice things. A lot of the time, they were carrying out this pacification program of counterinsurgency. And then when the suffering was too much and people started to fight back, they decided that you have to control the population. So they began what was known as the Kui Khu Kui Up, which means areas, big areas where they put people, you know, in, they try to separate the bad apples from the good apples, so to speak. And that failed. So in, so they started, you know, what was known as the Agroville, and now again, Agroville is a French word, means agricultural city or something like that, when you mass a lot of villages together and control them. Excuse me. And that failed, and then, you know, by 1961, they started what was known as a strategic hamlet. And the strategic hamlet typically had 100 families in each, with stockade, barbed wire fences, spike moats, and around soldiers guarding the four corners of a strategic hamlet. People were not allowed to leave the hamlet after a certain time in the evening, and was not before a certain time in the evening, was not allowed to come back a certain time in the afternoon. They would move very far away from their paddy fields and farms. And as a result, in many areas, especially in central part of Vietnam, there were massive starvation. And I have documented this thing in detail in many articles and books, so I don't want to go into that here. But when I protested, you know, to my higher-ups, saying that, you know, you are making people suffer, you are producing more communists, you know, than you are an enemy, and so forth and so on. People said, Long, you're very naive. This is how we defeat the communists in Malaysia. This is how we defeated them in the Philippines. And by golly, we are going to defeat them in Vietnam, too, very, very quickly. Well, it turned out that that was not the case. So, again, to make the story short, they had to escalate the pacification program and counterinsurgency. Because by 1963, when 80% of the rural population in the Mekong Delta, for example, were grouped into the strategic hamlets, the Diem regime was confronted with tremendous popular opposition, not only in the countryside, but also in the cities, by Buddhist students, and so forth and so on. The United States decided that Diem had become a liability, so the United States supported a coup, if not to say staged it, and by November of 1963, Diem died, was killed. When Diem was killed, the pacification program totally collapsed. Most of the strategic hamlets had been dismantled. And there was nothing the United States could do for 2 years. So finally, the United States had to send American Marines into Vietnam in March of 1965. And there has been a lot of controversy in this country about how we did not have troops built up in Vietnam fast enough, you know. But you see, troops built up in Vietnam was much faster than troops built up in the first Gulf War and Iraq War in terms of numbers. And when American troops went to Vietnam, most of their efforts went into pacification, as well as the efforts of the South Vietnamese soldiers. And pacification, again, is counterinsurgency. The idea here is this, and put people in this new, now they call it New Life Hamlet. They don't call it strategic hamlet, they call it New Life Hamlet. Presumably that you would have a new life if you get put into these concentration camps. And they call it Up Tân Sinh. Tân Sinh is a Sino-Vietnamese word. And so when there was tremendous resistance on the part of the Vietnamese, they decided maybe that Sino-Vietnamese word, the people of Vietnam couldn't understand, so they changed it into colloquial Vietnamese. They call it Up Đời Mới, which means the same thing, which means New Life Hamlet. But they translated back into English, they call it the New Life Hamlet, if you remember. And there were professors here at the university, at MIT, you know, who supported this program. If you remember, Professor Chomsky talked about this, you know, and professor at Harvard too. One of my professors at Harvard was Sam Huntington, you know, supported this pacification program and all that kind of thing. But anyway, I want to wouldn't talk about it later. Again, to make the story short, by 1972. This massive counterinsurgency program, from 1965 to 1972, this massive counterinsurgency program was directed basically against the civilian population in Vietnam. Or as an American general said it, you know, by golly, you know, if the Viet Cong are just like fish swimming in water, you know, which is the population, then by golly, we are going to dry up the ocean, but in the sea, then we are going to dry up the sea, and so they put people in this new life hamlet, and made refugees out of millions of people. By 1972, according to official U.S. sources, about 12 million people out of a total population of 18 million people had been made refugees. And many of them were living in refugee camps and in this new life hamlet. And that was the extent of counterinsurgency in Vietnam. And of course, you see, if you look at figures of casualties, the Vietnamese claim eventually after 30 years, actually they claim about 25 years ago, that there were 3 million Vietnamese killed in the war, most of them in the south. And the majority of people who were killed in the south were civilians. And that was counterinsurgency. Let me now try to link it to what is happening now here in Iraq. They are talking about counterinsurgency. And they think that this time it's different because the resistance in Iraq is not as strong as in Vietnam. And so, you know, win-win. As if winning or victory would justify what they are doing to the people in Iraq. What I'm trying to say is that they managed to kill most of the revolutionaries already from the period from 1954 to 1956 or 57. But because of the suffering of the people in the South, the people in the South fought back. They did not have to receive orders from the North. In fact, the North forbade them to fight back. So my question is, how much of the suffering that is being is being imposed on the Iraqi people, you know, would make the whether the suffering of, you know, that's being imposed on the people in Iraq would not make them take up arms and fight back? Whether you have support from Syria or Iran or whatever or not. And even if they, you know, I mean, they were to be defeated, your question is whether that's right or not. We hear so little about the suffering, you know, that the civilian population in Iraq, you know, have to endure. Every day we hear that there's, you know, some terrorists blow up some American trucks here and there and that kind of thing, this kind of body counts. But what about civilian population there? And the suffering there, you know, whether that would fit into the quote-unquote insurgency or not. And if it does, then would the United States be able to withdraw from Iraq very soon, as Bush says, or whether the United States will stay in there for a much longer time, imposing more suffering on the people of Iraq. So if there is anything that we can learn from Vietnam, is that you should not underestimate nationalism, and you should not underestimate people's desire for freedom and independence and democracy and all of that. They are going to fight back because these are good values. These are values that they praise, and not because they are afraid of all the destruction caused by the United States. Let me stop there, and then we can talk about things later. Let me make one proposal to amend what Linda said, is that instead of me answering question now, let me suggest let Professor Chomsky talk first, and the two of us would answer your questions after he gives his talk. Okay? Thank you.